Hello, everyone. This is Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Welcome back. How's it been, Jordan?
Pretty good. Starting my classes.
Oh, right. Today is your... Was today your first day?
It was the second week of classes, but one of mine I had for the first time today. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been that long since we last saw each other. I road tripped from New Mexico back to Florida, so that was a super long drive, but I stopped in Austin to see you.
Yes.
And actually, we're recording this earlier than usual. We're recording this the day that the Per Kirkaby episode came out. So, because I am going to Lebanon in 2 days. I will be in Lebanon when this episode comes out, I think. Or maybe I'll be back by then. Who knows? But, yeah, very exciting. I haven't been home in 3 years, so I've been really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm excited that you're able to go there, see family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of feelings, but yeah, mostly excitement.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I need to reacclimate to traveling for 18 hours by plane. I used to do it all the time, but now it's been a while. I've gotten so used to domestic flights. Yeah. I've been spoiled, but it's okay.
I'm going to be crossing every finger that your planes are not delayed.
Thank you.
That the travel goes smoothly, just because it's so hit or miss. And so,
I know.
Yeah, really, really hoping for the best for you since it's such a long journey.
You know what's funny? People think I'm weird for saying this, but you know what I'm actually looking forward to?
What?
Kind of. Airplane food.
Why?
Because I'm so sick of those Lotus cookies and pretzels. Like, I'm actually looking forward to a meal. I haven't had a meal on a plane in 3 years, so I'm excited for it.
Yeah, you know, sometimes they're really good. Like, I...
Agreed.
When I went to Denmark, it was either when I went or when I was coming back, the dinner was really, really great, actually. And
there you go.
Yeah, it's... I don't know, it's like, sometimes, yes, maybe they're not... They're not as good as, like, what you would make or what you would get in a restaurant.
No,
but
of course not.
It's kind of just fun, though, to get your little tray with your meal and unroll the silverware. And
agreed.
Yeah, I don't know.
There is a sense of excitement there. And, you know, I've always flown Air France internationally. This was my first time flying at Delta. So who knows?
Oh.
Maybe the cuisine will be a little different, you know, it's something more exciting. I don't know. We'll see.
I will say that I took Delta to Denmark, and I also flew Delta when I studied abroad 3 years ago, and their food is pretty good, and I mean, I'm sure maybe other airlines might do this as well, but with Delta, you get a free alcoholic beverage with your meal.
You do?
Yes, so you could get a little glass of wine, you could get a little gin and tonic, So that,
On this episode of Major Musings, airplane food.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. That's not
Surprise.
What's happening. Surprise. No. Sorry to disappoint everyone, but that's not what this episode is about. Anyways, so today actually is about the artist Baya. I mentioned this at the end of last week's episode, but for those who didn't hear that one, her full name is Baya Mahyadeen, but she, for reasons unknown, she wanted to be referred to as just Baya. So that's how I'm going to refer to her throughout the remainder of this episode.
Cool.
But yeah, I don't think, Jordan, I've briefly told you about her while I was researching her at UChicago, but I don't think we've ever had a full conversation about her work before.
No, and Maria sent me some photos of her work before the episode, and this is the first time that I have seen her work as well. So
yeah.
I also am pretty unfamiliar with her.
Okay, yeah, and I'll include the paper I wrote in our link tree as well for people to just look at that if you prefer that over maybe listening. And the images I sent Jordan will be on our Instagram as per usual. But yeah, I'm excited to tell you more about her and to tell everyone else about her.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll just dive right in. First and foremost, brief overview of Orientalism. So I feel like I've probably mentioned this in episodes past. One that comes to mind is the one on Lala Saide from season one, where I discussed Orientalism. When thinking about it and its subsequent imagery, I would like to turn to Edward Said and his definition of Orientalism. He dubbed the term as a Western style for dominating, restructuring, and having authority over the Orient. So, you know, yes, the history of Orientalism within the Western canon has been problematic at best, with the artists of the 20th century appropriating the artifacts and craftsmanship of a colonized region for the sake of developing their own quote-unquote unique stylistic characteristics. Thinking of an example, we can turn to the names of some of the most prominent artists of the century, namely Pablo Picasso. And I mention him because what is a conversation about Orientalism and modern art if not for the likes of Picasso? Namely, his painting Les Femmes d'Alger, which is Women of Algeria in English. His painting, which again can be found on our Instagram or you can Google it if you'd like, points to the most important factor in this equation. You know, she who has been oppressed, objectified, exoticized, erased from offering her own narrative, the Algerian woman. In art historical scholarship that has been produced, artists like Picasso are placed on a pedestal, quite frankly, and nowhere is the voice of the very subject matter they have violated in their representations been amplified. I think in today's discourse, we're trying to unravel that more and more. Scholars have begun to acknowledge the damage of colonial literal and visual renderings of the Algerian women, among other women of North Africa or the Middle East. And so she begins to surface through those like her who have been silenced in the past. And one such individual is Baya. She is a very young girl from Algeria. She was 16 years old when she caught the eyes of the Parisian art circle, including the likes of André Breton, who was the founder of Surrealism. This was in the... It began 1947 and into the early 1950s. She was born in Algeria. Her name actually wasn't Baya originally. She was originally Fatima Haddad, and she was orphaned at the age of five. She lived with her paternal grandmother, who worked as a housekeeper for the French intellectual Marguerite Camina Benhura. Because of being around her, since her grandmother was the housekeeper, Benhura got connected to Baya really quickly. And as Baya reached her teenage years, Benhura adopted her and became her surrogate mother, supporting her through an education as well as being an advocate for her art. So, you know, in that way, it's really a relief to see that, you know, to see that she encouraged Baya to continue creating art, and she provided her with art materials and even showed her own collection that she had, which included works by many well-known modern artists like Picasso, Georges Braque, Henri Matisse, and Joan Miró. And, you know, as wonderful of a guardian and supporter Benhura was, this is in accordance with what Baya has said about her, it's kind of hard to ignore the colonial implications of the relationship. At least it was for me as I was doing research on her. I'm sure everyone is somewhat familiar, or at least, I don't know if you are, Jordan, with the term, you know, white savior. For those who don't know, it's essentially when white people kind of look at a person of color who perhaps is lesser of in status and wants to quote-unquote rescue them or guide them to feel better about themselves. Kind of. So Benhura is the perfect example of a white savior, because she looked at Baya as someone to somehow save the inferior Algeria and subject to French culture and art to kind of make her better, in a sense.
I see.
And indicative of this problematic dynamic is the way that Benhura was quoted describing young Baya. She called her, she called her a wild and barefoot child, making fascinating small animals and strange female figures out of dirt.
Yeah. Wild, just off the bat, is...
I know. And strange female figures. When all of Baya's imagery are abstract renderings of the Algerian woman. So to call them strange female figures and, you know, essentially reducing the medium to dirt is... It's a lot. The image that Ben-Hur has of Baya is unsettling, especially, as you pointed out, with her use of wild as a descriptor of her personality. You know, the age difference between them aside, however wiser Ben-Hur would have been as a result, this categorization of Baya, the Algerian girl, and her work subsumes a lesser-than relationship to Ben-Hur, the French woman. And, you know, let's be honest, it's highly unlikely that Ben-Hur would have called, say, a French child wild.
Yeah.
Probably not. So, it's a lot. It's a very complex relationship. But, you know, despite such a troubling account of the girl, Ben-Hur's emotional and financial support of Baya never wavered. And the latter spoke highly of her and of her support as she was growing up. So, this eventually culminated into... In 1945, a French art dealer visiting Algeria. His name is M.A. Mait. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but the last name is M.A.E.G.H.T. So he was visiting Algeria, managing Pierre Bonnard's estate. And during that trip, someone introduced him to Baya's work. He was really interested in her art and actually proceeded to put together her first solo exhibition in Paris at his gallery in November of 1947. And I believe I've sent you one of the images, and again, this will be available on Instagram, but one of the images is a black and white photograph of Baya standing in the gallery space at her exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
So Mait enthusiastically shared the news of Baya to André Breton, again, the founder of Surrealism, who proceeded to include one of her gouaches in the International Surrealist Expo in July 1947.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he was very interested in her. Breton also wrote an essay accompanying Baya's solo exhibition. Unsurprisingly, perhaps even worse so than Ben-Hur, he exoticized Baya and her practice in accordance with what his image of Algeria was. Much like his description of many other non-European artists, Frida Kahlo comes to mind here when he called her he called her a bomb with a bow wrapped around it.
Right.
Baya was susceptible to his pervasive tropes of the Orient. He was markedly infatuated with Baya's practice, rashly categorizing her as surrealist in the same way that he called Kahlo surrealist. And he spoke of her gouaches as childlike and primitive dreamscapes, among other disturbing statements.
Just real quick, looking at her work, surrealist is not the first word that comes to mind.
No, not at all.
Yeah, that is a stretch by Breton.
Exactly. She's complete, stylistically, if anything, maybe you could make that argument that Kahlo could have had some surrealist characteristics in her paintings, mm-hmm. maybe, but because they were so personal, it's kind of absolutely not. But with Baya, nothing about her works are surrealist in any way, shape, or form. So this is just another example of how they would turn to other cultures and kind of categorize them as unrealistic, as beyond the norm, which is a really horrible thing to do.
Yeah.
And many artists from history are still having their legacies kind of tainted as a result. And, you know, not once in his essay in the exhibition catalog, not once does he reference a single gouache in the text. He speaks in very broad strokes and homogenizes her entire practice. I'm going to read an excerpt here from his essay, and I guess all I have to say is brace yourself.
Oh, God.
So he says, "And here, profiled in the gossamer fabric of the future, Baya's hieratic silhouette lifting a corner of the veil, uncovering what the young world, united, harmonic, and in love with itself, might be. Yes, she is still armed, it's true. It's undeniable that in her bag of marvels, love potions and spells rival extracts of perfumes from the Thousand and One Nights. This is because human desire is in a pure state within her, allowing no obstacle to impede its satisfaction, giving up, unbridled to its need for fulfillment.
What?
Do we all need a moment after that?
Yeah, I do. It's like floating around in my mind, just like, Breton, what are you talking about? Dude, come on.
I don't know. And then again, a lot of white men from the 19th and 20th centuries felt entitled to say these things, and now we look at them as though everything was facts. It was not. As if Ben-Hur's statement wasn't bad enough, here we're trying to unpack this.
Yeah.
First of all, nowhere does Breton make mention of Algeria by name, not just in this excerpt, but in the entire essay. Mm. He never says it, ever. He instead describes Baya and her Irv through the context of, again, a homogenized, essentialized image of the Orient more broadly. And his words, to put it lightly, are extremely objectifying and even sexual in nature, implicating that Baya reveals herself through, quote, a corner of the veil, and exposes her supposedly innate human desire to, quote, its need for fulfillment. Again, this is a 16-year-old girl that he's talking about.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Another layer of just uncomfortableness.
Extremely uncomfortable. And none of this is really surprising when you consider how Breton and other 20th century artists appropriated non-Western cultures, and especially the women of said cultures in their own practices. But what does draw concern is the way he sexualizes Baya, a teenage girl at the time. In his eyes, the non-Western woman is disembodied, deconstructed to satisfy his own fantasies, her age completely significant, so long as she fits into the box that he's made for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's so difficult for me to read all of this, and just, as I was writing the paper, all I wanted to do was lash out in anger as I was writing it, which I was very critical. But, you know, it's hard not to get emotional about these things. It's really frustrating to see this narrative perpetuated again and again.
Yeah. It also reminds me a little of how the surrealists look to psychiatric patients as well. I can't remember if I've talked about this in the last season, but I did, as you know, Maria,
yeah.
I did my undergrad thesis on Artaud and Van Gogh and looking at madness, and then I wrote another paper for the Dalí Museum about specifically surrealists looking to psychiatric patients, and it was the same sort of thing, just so othering. And even some of the language that Breton used writing about Baya, it reminded me of other writing by him or other surrealists talking about psychiatric patients' artwork.
It's pretty rough, and I mean, I'm glad that you've done research on this and written about it, because this is something that people need to understand and to learn about, and, you know, never take these guys for their word ever, because it's terrible.
Yeah.
50 years later, we're just reading and crying as we do. Cringing, I guess, is a better term.
Yeah, it's just frustrating, but that's why, I think it's great that you are bringing attention to her work.
Yeah. So, you know, all of this aside, in any case, the exhibition, not just Breton, but it led to Baya's encounter with Picasso.
Mm.
The show's success granted her an invitation to work as an artist in residence at the Madura Ceramic Workshop in Valori every summer from 1948 till 1952. And that's where she shared a studio space right next to Picasso.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So once more, this was another dynamic where the French individual underscored Baya's agency as anything beyond her cultural identity. Apparently, he often referred to her as la Berbère, which is the Berber, a person indigenous to North Africa. Because, you know, what's the point of a name? What's the point of referring to someone by their name?
Yeah, just call her by the generalizing term. That's
exactly
how that works. Yeah.
Perfect. Now, you know, although it's not wrong to view her pictorial representations as specific to Algeria, the harm stems from the hierarchies intertwined in the relations and descriptors of French individuals who had engaged with her at any level. So these relationships, troubling as they may be, I've already spent some time talking about them. I don't want to focus on them anymore. They've already had plenty of time in the limelight, consequently, you know, overshadowing any exclusive scholarship on Baya. So my talking about Benhura, Breton, and Picasso does not extend beyond just flat out condemning their behaviors in reinforcing Orientalist narratives. Their stories stop here, and that of Baya exclusively begins and shall continue in this episode. So my paper explored Baya's practice and how she presents a very unique pictorial interpretation of the Algerian woman and the land on which she exists. You know, how does she relate to practicing male artists at the time? How does she differ from them? The Algerian woman in Baya's oeuvre deviates from that presented in the works of European modernists, but she's hardly received any recognition as a standalone artist, instead viewed via the appropriative lens. I opt to move away from this, and I tried to offer an independent analysis of her imagery and her own appropriation of so-called modern techniques to produce a unique line of work. So, actually, as I was doing the research, I found that there was an exhibition at Gray Art Gallery, which is the NYU gallery, in 2018. It was the first ever in North America, two Wow. decades after her passing.
Wow.
Yeah. Their catalog is some of the most comprehensive scholarship on the artist, including reflections of Breton, which were translated from French, and the famed Algerian author Asia Jabbar. So I was really happy to see that Asia Jabbar had written on Baya and that it was included in the exhibition catalog, because coincidentally I was taking a second class that same quarter called Gendering Arabs, and it was in the creative writing department at UChicago, and one of the novels we read was by Asia Jabbar, so it was nice to see that. But so in any case, Baya doesn't fit into the West's art historical agenda of so-called, you know, globalization. She's not at all critical about her country, never was. Her work instead demonstrated a very strong love for Algeria and resistance to French colonialism. Even with the supposed attention she gained from the Parisian art scene, she never resided there permanently. She actually eventually married into a traditional Algerian family and lived in Algeria until her death in 1998.
Wow.
Yeah. So let me start talking about a few of her paintings at this point. Take, for instance, a painting like Femme Robe Jeune, Cheveux Bleus, which is translates directly to Women with Blue Hair and Yellow Dress. This was a gouache on board from 1947. Now, as is typical in most of her works, the woman in the frame takes center stage, but she simultaneously blends into her surrounding environment. In terms of her body, not much is visible, apart from her exaggeratedly small waist. But even still, it doesn't really evoke the same sexual tropes as those of the Western man's representations. Everything else is obscured from view, including the hands and feet, which seems to be a common theme in much of Baya's imagery. The reason is unknown. It could be as simple as the fact that being 16 years old and self-taught, Baya just did not know how to accurately paint hands and feet. There is no question of the figure's femininity, yet Baya shields her from the male gaze. In my opinion, feet, and especially hands, or at least this is how I considered them as I was looking at her work, they're easy access to intimacy or physical touch. Mm-hmm. And by removing them here, she protects her figures from unwanted interactions. Instead, all eyes are on the very elaborate sleeves, the highly detailed wrap atop her head, and especially the bottom half of the dress. Now, what's so fascinating here is the scene it alludes to, or at least seemingly alludes to. There's a butterfly encircled by two birds at the front of the dress. And then those are encircled by some sort of outline containing them all together. This could be considered an allegory of fertility, with the birds representing the ovaries, the butterfly a symbol of the vulva, or perhaps the womb. There is a sensuality presented here as a result, but it isn't one that hypersexualizes the woman or objectifies her. It celebrates her maternity and connects her to nature as she blends into the background. And equally as attention-grabbing, not just in this painting, but in all of the paintings that Baya does, are the woman's eyes. They're here, thin slits, decorated with what is presumably some form of eyeliner, and they just pierce you directly. Mm-hmm. And her eyebrows are creased forward, her lips are pursed, but I don't know if it's really a look of anger, per se. It reads more as confident assertiveness, mm-hmm. in my opinion. It's like she's challenging the viewer to dare receive her as anything other than the powerful goddess that she really is.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think.
The first word that came to mind was defiant. And yeah. I think defiant can sometimes have a negative connotation, but I certainly don't think that here. I just think, yes, kind of what you were saying, like confident. Mm-hmm. She's defiant against the male gaze, like challenging you to not read her in this overly sexualized way.
Exactly.
The colors colors in this and in all of her other work, so stunning, so vibrant, really nice.
It's some of the most kind of visually appealing work that I've seen in a long time. The colors just jump out. She's not afraid to use color. You know, that's kind of what I get from this. And, you know, that, again, not to point to her age as though belittling her, but I feel like as a 16-year-old, she's not afraid about anything clashing. But at the same time, I feel like she geniusly blends colors together no matter how bright they are.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, that's kind of what I get from this. And again, nothing else on her body needs to be revealed apart from the face, from the eyes. Her gaze reveals all. So no doubt this is a powerful woman, one who probably evokes a vision that Baya would have had of her late mother.
Mm.
So, you know, looking at these works, not only is it depictions of a very strong Algerian woman, but also a way for Baya to reflect on her loss of her mother, to reflect on someone who could have been a leading figure in her life had she still been around.
Yeah.
So I think that adds another really beautiful, complex layer here.
And just real quick, this isn't super related to what you were just talking about, but in looking at this work and some of her other ones, I noticed there's a lot of patterning throughout. Are these, do you know if these were just motifs and images that she liked, or are these traditional to Algerian dress and how women might dress themselves, or do you know like where these came from?
Right, yeah. So to my knowledge, I think the repetitiveness of a lot of these motifs are a reflection of the Algerian landscape that she wanted to portray in these. I'm not sure how accurate the dresses themselves are. I would guess that probably there is likelihood that she was connecting all of these from traditional Algerian dress, probably, on top of the landscape, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So, you know, It's really fascinating, and painting has been attributed traditionally as a Western medium, which is why so many modern Arab artists creating paintings would have never been credited as producing original work.
Mm.
Instead, their practices are deemed replications of existing Western imagery. And as a result, Baya was sentenced to erasure from the history of art before we could even begin to take a serious look at her paintings. So I wanted to change that in writing about her and in talking about her now. I wanted to demonstrate the strength of her practice as one promoting almost a reclamation of the Algerian woman's agency. Her gaze takes precedence above the male of the Orientalist gaze. Some could argue that her paintings are akin to those of Matisse's color schemes, maybe, the bold colors, or Picasso's cubist abstractions. But that similar to what Breton was trying to do, that defeats the purpose of what her work is all about. It's about conveying the beauty of the Algerian woman specifically, especially as a means through which she honored her mother. And Baya herself had proclaimed that she was born an artist, considering the fact that she caught the eyes of a notorious art dealer who went as far as to give her a solo show in Paris at such a young age. That is a fair assessment to make about herself.
Mm-hmm.
I know I said I'd stop talking about the other ones earlier and to just condemn them, but I did want to briefly talk about how it has been contended whether Baya would have inspired Picasso and his Les Femmes d'Alger painting.
Okay.
So Picasso created this painting as a response to Eugène Delacroix's own literal and visual manifestations of Algerian women from his voyages to the country. Again, Picasso's painting and Delacroix's painting will be on our Instagram, so you can see the two of them. Delacroix's painting is somehow... they're both terrible, but somehow worse than Picasso's by just a tad.
Yeah.
Because he bluntly portrays the woman, all of the women in his painting, as hypersexualized or eroticized. But what's even more frustrating is you look at his painting, and most of them have Eurocentric features. If you look at the, they look white.
Yeah. He's,
they look like white women.
He's really bleached their skin.
Yeah. Very much so. And, you know, Delacroix has aptly been titled a colonialist, and for good reason. His imagery is the archetype of the Orientalist gaze. He dehumanizes the Arab or North African woman and places her in the frame as readily available to him, to the European man.
Mm-hmm.
And in taking inspiration from this, Picasso also is inadvertently colonial in his practice, using Cubist techniques to further disfigure the Algerian woman and present her as a symbol of pleasure above all else. You know, they're all in the nude, essentially, in Picasso's painting.
Yeah.
Leave it to him to take inspiration from a painting where the women are relatively covered up, relatively is a loose term, and then do the exact opposite in his version.
Yeah.
Now, although Picasso himself has cited his time at Madura with Baya as one of his inspirations for Les Femmes d'Alger, I feel it almost inappropriate to even consider, not because she would have been less talented than him by any means, but because the agency she grants the women in her paintings is completely, completely non-existent in his renderings. Those primarily catered to the Western male gaze. And despite what he may have said, my opinion of this is that it would be unfair to assess any sort of pictorial connection out of respect for Baya and her empowering imagery of the Algerian woman. All the theories I read, everyone goes back and forth. People think, oh no, it's just a replica of Delacroix's painting, or oh no, he would have never said that Baya inspired him. But I say, yes, he did. It's quoted that he did, but I refuse. That's my opinion, because it does her a disservice to connect her to him in this way.
Yeah.
When Picasso and others like him presented an eroticized subject matter for the pleasure of the European man, over and over again, Baya gave all the agency to the women in her compositions. Their bodies are celebrated as intimately connected to the land and often evoking symbols of fertility, but it's their gazes especially which end up dominating the composition. A woman alone, as with the woman in the yellow dress and blue hair, is one perspective of Baya's craft, but there are also quite a few gouaches that depict two women together, one aptly titled Deux Femmes, which translates to two women, also from 1947. Now, if there was a hint of sensuousness in her previous painting, it is noticeably absent here. The typical curves that you would expect from a woman's body are ambiguously tied to the folds of the dresses themselves that essentially engulf the women. Once again, no hands or feet are visible, except for maybe a glimpse of one through the sleeve of the woman in the yellow dress, but the both of them do hypothetically hold hands, establishing a connection between them. The abstract fluidity of their bodies makes it really difficult to determine how they're positioned in the composition, but their faces are in profile, and the eyes here are even more commanding than in the last piece. Only one eye is visible for each of them, but they hold just as much power as a full gaze. The facial proportions are exaggerated. The eyes take up almost the entire face, while the lips are like tiny bows just below the tips of their very sharp noses. The relationship to the viewer is a bit unclear. You know, you kind of ask yourself, are they staring at the viewer from the profile? Are they looking at one another? In any case, they're the ones that are fully in control, and there is a connection between them that is unmatched. So here I would like to reflect on Asiya Jabbar's essay while looking at this painting. So she's, like I mentioned, a famed Algerian author, and she touches on the intimacy between the women. So she says here, everything comes together and is intertwined, is involved in an exchange. Fertility and innocence. Women, sometimes two of them, become sisters. More often than not, there's a solitary queen standing in a realm of flora, scents, chirping. Everything is made flush, flat, rich, moments of gathering. Everything except man. He would be the guardian. He would hold the keys. He would say no entering, no touching, no leaving. He is beyond. He is beneath this recreated Eden. He will never be the subject of Baya's gaze. Yes. Wow. Man is irrelevant here. Finally.
Yeah.
It's after reading Breton's essay and then moving into this one, it was just such a breath of fresh air and so beautifully written.
Yeah, that's, I was gonna say that too. Very powerful.
Very powerful, very poetic. Mm-hmm. And again, man is irrelevant, both as subject matter and as potential passerby or viewer. Not only that, his presence is also unwanted. Mm-hmm. It's not just non-existent, it's unwanted.
Unneeded,
for it would otherwise seek to control the woman and the agency in the space that she occupies. He will never be the subject of Baya's gaze, which is such a powerful statement. Mm-hmm. And it's further confirmation of Picasso or Breton's BS.
Yeah.
It's not the issue of the Algerian man here. Rather, the threat posed at the hands of the Western man, of his colonial gaze, and the stereotypes he would proceed to subject onto these women to satisfy his own sexual fantasies. Now, in addition to these symbols of fertility that I've mentioned, that Jabbar has mentioned, what I wanted to close with is the reiteration of the Algerian woman's relationship to the environment surrounding her in Baya's work, in the same way that Jabbar categorized her as flat, flush with the richness of the landscape. A lot of it is, since you asked about this earlier, Jordan, a lot of it is composed from repetitive natural or organic elements like flora, fauna, fruits, fish. The relationship is so intrinsic to the composition that sometimes it's difficult to pinpoint exactly where the silhouettes of the women end and the background begins. Take, for example, this painting of the gouache of the two women. In the first one, you could see the black hair clearly. But in this one, their hair is essentially part of the background as well. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the richness of the Algerian landscape. If you look at on a surface level, the imagery produces similar tropes of woman and nature as belonging to one another, in the same way that artists like Picasso or Matisse would have depicted women in nature. But Baya doesn't do it in the same way. The Western male artist presents the non-Western woman alongside nature through the lens of primitivism. But Baya does so in a manner that challenges this dynamic and instead contextualizes the relationship of the woman to the land in an act of resistance, I think. It's really evident from the intensity of the women's gazes. Baya's subjects, in relation to their surrounding environments, extends beyond stereotypical ideals of woman and nature from the Orientalist point of view. Her figures demonstrate not so much primitivism, rather the interweaving of human with non-human, in opposition to French colonialism on Algerian land. The confrontational gazes of the women are thus heightened in this context, alluding to any Western viewers that this space is their own, and that the latter can look but can never touch. And in their interwoven state with the surrounding natural elements evoking the land, it implies that if you violate one, you'd be violating the other. You violate the land, you violate the woman, you violate the woman, you violate the land. Everything is interconnected. Non-Western countries, like Algeria, have frequently been feminized in colonial history. And Baya's imagery presents us with this allegory head-on. And the deep ties her subjects have to their surrounding environment, it's impossible to separate one from the other, which illuminates you as a viewer to the implications of colonial violence. In conquering the land, you inadvertently seek to conquer its women. But as is evident from their gazes, they will not lay passively. They will always resist, and they will always fight for the right to their land and the right to their bodies.
Amen.
And that is what I have today on Baya Mahiddin.
Awesome.
Yeah.
She is very cool. I really love all of her works.
Me too.
And I am very glad that you chose to talk about her and bring light to her.
I'm very glad too. I don't know if I said this in the beginning, but the class I was taking was with a curator at the Art Institute of Chicago.
Okay.
And the class was called Gender and Sexuality in Modern European Art.
Oh.
Yeah, so I know. So I love the curator's method of teaching, and she wanted us to really write about whatever interests us.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that sexuality, at least from the male perspective, has been presented in European art has always really frustrated me.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely didn't want to go that route. And so, you know, when I found Baya, I was so excited. I was nervous initially. And I thought, oh my God, this might be a little too far away from the topic. I hope that the curator will be happy about it. So I email her and she's like, yes, absolutely. Write about this. Do it. Let's go. And I'm like, yay. Okay.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I was very happy with how it came out.
Good.
Yeah. Again, I will share the paper on our link tree. I'll put that together at some point, maybe on the plane as I'm flying home. But yeah.
Awesome.
That was Baya.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I know this is not long after the release of Kirkaby, but do you have any idea what you're going to be talking about next time?
No. I am just, you know, with the start of the classes and...
That's valid.
With the other episode... I just had not yet thought about what I wanted to pick for our next one. So
no worries.
Listeners, it's going to be a surprise.
Can't wait. I love surprises. I'm sure everyone else does. And if you don't, you'll learn to love them.
Yeah.
Audience.
It's fine. It'll be a one-time thing. I will have my artists in place, I promise.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to it. Thank you for sitting with me and talking about her.
Of course.
And I look forward to what comes next.
Yes. Wishing you a great trip to Lebanon.
Thank you. I'll keep you posted.
Of course. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.